Our reading this morning comes from the book of Nehemiah, as we are doing a series on Nehemiah. We have reached chapter 2. We have a little way to go. And the reading this morning is from verse 1 onwards. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was bought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruin and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favour in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, "If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governor of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct when I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy?" And because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my request. So I went to the governor of Trans-Euphrates and gave him the king's letter. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite officials heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Do you know, I've been thinking recently that there are a lot of things in life that seem impossible. Or if you like, there are a lot of things in life that are very unlikely to happen. For instance, there's such things as England winning the World Cup, or the coalition government lasting well into the future, or the weather ever being really nice again. You know, there are a lot of things that you can't at this point ever imagine happening. And some of these things are really big and really important, such as war ending all over the world, or public shootings no longer hitting the headlines and coming up again and again, or poverty being a thing of the past. Things that unfortunately have become part of everyday life, and they seem like they'll never go away. And then there are other things which are comparatively trivial compared to the things I've just mentioned, but still seem impossible. Things such as trying to make everyone happy. This doesn't work. Fitting everything into the time that we have. Or resisting the leftover chocolates from Christmas. Things which personally we find impossible to do, but on a grand scale of things, they don't have a huge impact on the world. There are many things in life that seem impossible. I remember when I was 7, I thought it was impossible to stay awake all night. I just couldn't achieve it. I think my mum had actually told me it was impossible. I realise now why she might have told me that. But I thought, well, surely it can be done. So I remember one night I set myself up to stay awake all night. I had some snacks. I had a little lamp which I put on. I had my book to read. And I thought, when my parents go to bed, I'm going to put on my lamp and I'm going to stay awake all night. I'm going to eat my snacks when I feel a little bit hungry. I'll read my book when I feel a bit tired. That hadn't quite worked out. That might send me to sleep. And I'll stay awake all night. I'll prove it's possible. I woke up in the morning to find that I'd failed in my task. And I decided then that it was impossible to stay awake all night. Of course, I've learned over recent months that it's perfectly possible to stay awake all night, especially when your child's crying. The hard thing is to stay awake the day after and do some good work. So this sermon's going to be great, isn't it? You see, there are things in life which at some point or other seem to be impossible. And then there are those things in life which most people would agree are actually impossible. There are things that seem impossible, but then there are those things that are impossible. For instance, it's widely agreed that it's impossible to tickle yourself. I don't know whether you know that. It's also impossible to sneeze with your eyes open. Apparently many people have tried. It's impossible to go back in time and change the past. Much to some people's disappointment, it's actually impossible to accurately predict everything about the future. And it is, of course, impossible to be in two places at one time, although we try, many of us. Things which aren't just impossible for us, but are impossible for everyone. And you know, here in the book of Nehemiah, in the passage that we've just read, we find something taking place which fits into the impossible category. Something which most people of the time would have said was absolutely impossible. Not just improbable or unlikely, but impossible. And it takes place here in chapter 2, when Nehemiah is in conversation with King Artaxerxes. Now, of course, the conversation itself is not impossible. As we heard last week, Nehemiah was a cupbearer for the king. He was a servant of King Artaxerxes. He was a wine taster, which meant that he tasted the wine to see if it was poisoned before the king had it. And in this position, he would no doubt have had many conversations with the king. This was not the impossibility. What was deemed impossible at the time was the question which Nehemiah subsequently brought to the king, which was this: if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favour in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it. You see, as we know, Nehemiah was a descendant of the people of Judah. And having heard the plight of Jerusalem, the plight of his people, the state of the walls, the weakness of the city, Nehemiah longed to go back and lead people in rebuilding the walls to make the city safe, so that it would once again be the home of God's people. However, because Nehemiah was in the employment of the king, to go back to Jerusalem, he first, of course, needed permission from the man who now ruled over the once great kingdom of Judah, who was, of course, King Artaxerxes. So he approaches him with this question: can I go back and rebuild my city? Now, as an outsider, we might think, well, you know, I can see how that question might be a little awkward, asking your employer if you can go on your own personal adventure while they have to find someone else. But why would it be deemed impossible for the king to grant Nehemiah's request? Well, here's the thing. For starters, the king is a sworn enemy of Judah. His predecessors, after all, defeated the people of God, the people of Judah, and destroyed Jerusalem, trying to wipe it off the face of the earth. So the king now takes for granted the services of these dispersed Jews, including Nehemiah, to prosper his own kingdom. And the restoration of Jerusalem would obviously affect what he has now taken for granted. And as the ruler of Persia, King Artaxerxes is also the most powerful man around at the time. He rules over many minor kingdoms that make up this great kingdom of Persia, meaning at this time in history, he is unchallenged as the leader of any area around. He's the ruler that everyone is afraid of, because Jerusalem, that used to be great, has been destroyed and is no more. And not only this, but concerning the rebuilding of Jerusalem specifically, he's also made his views clear. Back in the book of Ezra, before Nehemiah, when the Temple of Jerusalem was restored by a group of believers, King Artaxerxes worried that the power of the Israelite people would become too great, issued a royal decree. a royal decree which said they should not finish the work until he so decided. You see, he wasn't just historically against the rebuilding of Jerusalem because his ancestors had destroyed it. He was actively against it, actively stopping the people rebuilding Jerusalem. He wanted to preserve his Persian Empire no matter what. And so when Nehemiah approaches him at his royal banquet, the likelihood of the king responding favourably to the question of restoring Jerusalem, that city which he has destroyed, is absolutely non-existent. What Nehemiah wants in this time in history is impossible. Absolutely impossible. It's not going to happen. And yet, when Nehemiah approaches the king and asks permission, we find that instead of being dismissed and then executed, most probably, the king miraculously agrees. First to the idea of letting Nehemiah go in the first place, and then to all his other requests, sending with Nehemiah a letter of protection to enable him to get to Jerusalem, a letter of permission to enable him to get materials to rebuild Jerusalem, and royal army officers and cavalry to ride with him on his journey to make sure he gets there. Not only does the king do a complete turnaround on his royal decree, he adds all these little bonuses in to make Nehemiah's task much easier. Which, when we think about it, is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. But the question is, why does he do this? Why does the king, against the odds, agree to Nehemiah's request? Was he getting a bit bored of being unchallenged? I'll try and build another kingdom. Did he make a mistake because it was a banquet and he didn't really hear, he had too much wine? I don't know. Maybe. Some people would probably argue that. But the evidence we have doesn't suggest that fact. In fact, the evidence we have suggests quite the opposite. The king was in his rightful mind when he made these decisions. And actually, it wasn't the generosity or mistakes of the king that aided Nehemiah that day. Instead, the evidence suggests that it was the sovereignty of God working through the situation. It was the actions of Almighty God himself that made this impossible task possible. After all, what did Nehemiah do when he first heard about the plight of his people? He prayed, he fasted, he mourned, he wept, he called out to God to make a way for him to be able to go back to Jerusalem. And it wasn't as if he just did this out of habit, you know, I suppose I should pray now. He did it believing. He did it believing in his God, believing in the God who had brought the Israelites out of Egypt, believing in the God who had parted the Red Sea, who had given them manna from heaven, who had destroyed the walls of Jericho, who had defeated the Midianites, who had given David victory over Goliath. Nehemiah believed that that same God, his God, could also bring about victory for him. And so he called out to him. He cried out to him to make a way. And sure enough, the God of Israel didn't let him down. Because the God of Israel was a sovereign God. And his ability to achieve the impossible was unrivaled. Do you know, I was reading a book the other day by Brother Andrew. Don't know whether you know who Brother Andrew is. He used to smuggle Bibles. And he's written a number of books. And he was telling a story in one of his books about a Catholic priest from Romania who'd been helping to buy Bibles and smuggle them into people who hadn't got them for years. And on his last trip home, trying to smuggle Bibles into Romania, he got stopped at the border and he was ordered to unload his vehicle, at which point his cargo was discovered, hundreds of Bibles stored away in his car. The priest was a little bit anguished because he'd already been put in jail once and he couldn't deny there were Bibles there. There were hundreds of them stacked up on the table. And he was waiting to be told what would happen. When suddenly, a businessman pulled up at the border. A businessman who was quite well known to the guards at the time. And he stepped out and he walked breezily into the hut where all the Bibles were laid out. And he looked at them and he said, "Oh, Bibles! I assume they're confiscated." And the guards went, "Well, yes, of course they're confiscated. They're not allowed." And he went, "Well, can I buy them?" And they're like, "Well, why would you want Bibles? They're not very expensive. They're not going to go for much." And he went, "Oh, yes, you can get a lot for Bibles. In fact, I'll give you a large amount for them," at which point he whispered into the guard's ear the amount of money he would give. The official's eyes grew quite wide. And he said, "Well, they can't be worth that much." And the businessman said, "Oh, you'd be surprised." So the guards had a little confab. And then it seemed the price was right. They turned around and they said, "Okay, you can take the Bibles." And so the businessman, with the help of the priest, loaded the Bibles into his car and drove through the border into Romania to give out the Bibles. The Catholic priest was still standing at the table, which was now empty, a little bit awkward. And he said, "So, am I under arrest?" And the guard said, "Well, there's no Bibles here, so you may as well go on your way. There's nothing to arrest you for." The Bibles got in to Romania, and so did the priest, maybe not together. But a way was made when it seemed impossible for anything to happen. And you know, I find this quite challenging when I read Nehemiah, when I hear stories like that, because although we're not in the same situation as Nehemiah, and we're not in the same situation as the Catholic priest, we're still the people of God. We follow the same God that made these things possible. A God who is all-powerful, a God who is all-knowing, a God who is almighty. The God, if you like, of the impossible. And yet, even though we follow the same God, and even though we know that we follow the same God, today we often treat him very differently. Because today, instead of being excited about the impossible things that God might be able to make possible, instead of calling out for these things to happen, we often tend, I think, to back away from him, treating him as if he's a God who maybe has little power or sometimes little care about the situations that we care about. Oh, sure, you know, we get excited about stories that we hear that maybe happen in other countries or in the Bible or things that we see that God is doing. But in our own lives, we often don't really seem to believe that the God who we follow can achieve the impossible. In fact, we're often quite surprised when he does. Oh, look, prayer's answered. Oh, God is sovereign. And, you know, we might say, "Well, Kate, times are different, aren't they? You know, we live in a different society. We live in a different time. We don't really see God do the impossible today. More often than not, we pray and things just carry on the same." Well, maybe that's true. But surely Nehemiah could have said the same. I mean, he was a Jewish believer, a descendant of Judah, one of the chosen people of God. And yet he'd spent his whole life living in a culture that disbelieved, watching as his enemies became more powerful, serving those who hated him, and seeing God seemingly do nothing about it. And yet when his chance arose to do something, when his chance arose to step up and to finally live as the person God had called him to be, Nehemiah's immediate response was not to dismiss it, just in case God didn't do anything. But instead, his immediate response was to go to God and to dare to believe. To dare to believe that despite all, God was still sovereign. Despite all he saw around him, God was still powerful. Despite all the disappointments over the years, God was still almighty. Even after all this time, as a dispersed person. Nehemiah's immediate response was to dare to believe that the God who had always prevailed in the past could once again make the impossible possible. And you know, I don't know about you, but I find this to be quite inspiring. Don't get me wrong, I'm not naive. I don't think that, you know, when we pray, everything always happens the way we want and there's no suffering and there's no problems. But this passage says to me that even though we may have been through difficult situations, even though we may feel worn down by what's happened, even though we might struggle to believe at times, even though we haven't seen God do anything for years, when we look at this passage, we can be assured that the God we worship is still an amazing God. That the God we worship is still an unfailing God. That the God we worship is still as faithful as he has ever been. And so if we, like Nehemiah, just have the courage to dare to believe, to dare to believe that the sovereign God we worship today can still make the impossible possible. And if we take the opportunity to call out to him, then I am sure that we would see that the God who has always prevailed in the past would still prevail today. Because, you know, we can come here every single week and we can listen and we can sing and we can pray and we can talk about the whys and wherefores of church and how good it was or bad it was. But until we dare to believe in the God who believes in us, all we're doing is simply filling time, filling pews. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to do that anymore. I want to see God change lives and make a difference.